This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. As always, my name is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Malcolm Etheridge, a self-proclaimed money nerd, which I am very happy to be able to say that about someone that's on this podcast, because I feel like myself included, definitely like to lump myself into that boat. But today we're going to be digging into some aspects of financial planning and also just kind of understanding how things like alternative assets can work into this. We have talked with many people in the past about, you know, the general nature of setting up a retirement plan and or at least a financial plan. And a lot of the times, you know, for good reason, we kind of focus on the, you know, more traditional side of things, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, because that works for the lion's share of people. But if anything has taught us about, you know, looking at finance, one size doesn't necessarily fit all, and understanding what different options are out there and that you're not just beholden to a stock market or an incredibly complex series of systems that are out there that, you know, are sometimes I feel kind of designed to keep us in the dark a little bit, and understanding that there really are tangible ways of investing and other ways of looking at this that, you know, for whatever reason, just don't have as much exposure. And that's what we really kind of try to bring with this show. So Malcolm, thank you very much for being on with us today. Maybe if you wouldn't mind giving us a bit of background about yourself and kind of how you became to be in the position of being a self-proclaimed money nerd, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, man. So I guess I should start in my day job. I run a financial planning firm based out of Rockville, Maryland, which for those not local to the area is like 45 minutes maybe outside of DC on a good day. Work with a number of tech executives, senior level folks in tech who basically have gotten to a place where their financial lives are way too chaotic and the problems that they're facing come with five-figure consequences if they get it wrong. That's usually where somebody comes and calls us. But separate and apart from that, the reason I like you, consider myself a money nerd is because all the stuff outside of my day job, right? Like I just released my first book called Financial Independence Doesn't Happen by Accident, which I'm very excited about because it's a lot of the same stuff that I am talking to those clients that I just referred to about on a daily basis, but breaking it down to a place where the average person who may not be there yet might be able to grab some of that intel to where they are and start earlier. Or you know how many do-it-yourselfers there are out there who, frankly, a lot of times tend to blow themselves up because part of doing it yourself is finding out the hard way when you make a mistake. And so maybe it helps some of those folks to kind of shorten that trajectory. So that's really where my point of emphasis is. I guess I should also point out I'm a certified financial planner. And so been doing this for, I think, 13 years now. This is like the thing that I eat, sleep, and breathe. When I say this, I mean money. And so that's, I guess, me in a nutshell.
Fantastic. Well, it's always interesting to, one, have people that, you know, views kind of align with my own, in a lot of ways, and also people that are in the similar point of their, you know, careers, especially in finance. You and I have been, you know, in finance for roughly about the same amount of time, getting my start back in the beginning of, or the end of 2011. So it's always, you know, cool to see, you know, people that are right in the same boat. So let's kind of tee off with that. You know, talking to the higher level of people, like you said, you know, tech executives where they have, you know, they make a mistake and it could be a six figure mistake with a governmental agency versus, you know, the common group of people. I think it's always good to kind of start with, you know, some of those mistakes and how they maybe necessarily apply, you know, the kind of the focus of what you wrote your book on. So, you know, let's kind of look at some of those core focuses that the everyday average person can look to and utilize when it comes to, you know, helping to build their financial portfolio.
You know what? The biggest thing to me is the level of, I think apathy is probably the most appropriate word that the majority of people have toward the IRS and toward taxes. So a lot of times, you know, people will go through great pains to optimize their portfolio to invest in the latest, greatest thing to try and catch that uptrend, right? NVIDIA at $100 a share or $500 a share or $700 a share, right? People are proud of themselves and patting themselves on the back because they caught that wave at the right time. Or Bitcoin even, right? I bought Bitcoin at $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, and look at me now, I'm such a genius. But then on the other side of that mountain is the IRS waiting on you to come down and have that sell. And that's the part where I think people make the biggest mistakes and pay the least amount of attention. And that befuddles me because really what good is all of the extra effort, all the time you put into reading about that thing, learning about that thing, getting yourself to a place where you felt really smart for investing in the latest, greatest, whatever. And then you turned around and sold on the 363rd day instead of waiting until you had held that thing long enough to qualify for long-term capital gains, just as an example. Those are the kinds of things that I see that blow me away when folks consider themselves to be, you know, pretty sophisticated when it comes to managing money.
Yeah, no, and that's always a good point. It's just kind of not understanding, you know, the basics of it. And I think that might be kind of a good place to start. You know, understanding, you know, investments from the perspective of, you know, where you're housing them, what that has to do with kind of the tax implications. Now, it's all well and easy, you know, if you've listened to this podcast for any appreciable amount of time, you know, we do this as an adjunct to being IRA custodians. So the, you know, basis of my clients that, you know, probably are tuning in, it's like, oh, well, I don't really have to worry about that. That's great. Well, you know, just as with any plan, you probably shouldn't put all of your eggs in one basket. And, you know, certainly you don't have all of your money in retirement plans. So things like dates and timing and understanding cost basis and short and long-term capital gains are vitally important to not, again, you know, in the sense of being less apathetic towards the IRS, because they're the ones that always get paid. No matter what, you're always going to pay them. So what are some other kind of core focuses, at least for people that are kind of the low hanging fruit to help avoid just those general mistakes where you're like, hey, I'm a genius, but only on half the coin?
Well, I think going further into something you were just saying, it's asset location versus asset allocation, right? So owning things that I know have a tremendous opportunity for appreciation inside of a taxable account when maybe I have the opportunity to own it inside of a tax deferred or a tax free account, right? So I myself am an angel investor sort of as a side. I won't even call it a hobby. It's part of my own personal financial independence plan. And so I invest in startups, but I do it inside of my self-directed IRA, ding, ding, right? Like the the buzzword bell. But legitimately thinking, if I invest $10,000, let's say, into some company that has the opportunity to have a 10x return, let's just say, because a lot of times when you're investing in venture, that's kind of the hope for any venture capital firm is that we'll have a 10 bagger that's in that portfolio somewhere that'll make up for all the other ones that are duds. If I have a 10x return on that $10,000 investment, that $90,000 delta is going to be taxable unless I've invested in that company inside of my IRA. In my case, it's inside of my Roth IRA. So I'm really never going to have to talk to the IRS about this money unless something has gone terribly wrong and I have to get my mitts on that money early, right? So that's the kind of strategy that I'm talking about here, where it's not necessarily just how do we reduce the amount of taxes that we pay in this year, and that's our only focus. It's how do we be strategic about the way we manage our assets from a tax planning perspective all of the time, and thinking about things like, yeah, I want to start investing because I have a little bit of excess free cash flow. What's the best place to own those assets? What's the best way to get those dollars into the investment? And frankly, it might be a little bit more work involved to get those dollars from my Roth IRA to my self-directed Roth IRA to the investment. But once it's done, right? It's not as easy as just clicking on a couple of buttons inside of my online brokerage account to get the dollars where I want them to go. But once it's done, like those dollars are in there, and 10 years from now, when the exit finally happens, that's when I'll care. So I think it's simple things like that when we talk about a tax planning, talk about it from a tax planning perspective. But then to take it a step further, I just mentioned, you know, folks who have excess free cash flow, and our brains normally would say, I either need to put this cash into my bank account, get a little bit of yield on that money instead of it just sitting in my checking account, paying me, you know, 0.001% or whatever it is. Or I'm a person who's inclined to put that money into the public stock market and say, you know, the average annual return of Vanguard total stock market is about 10%, which reflects the average return of the broader stock market over a rolling 10-year period. And that's great too. But what happens once I get past that point, if I'm so lucky, where I don't actually need to have the liquidity that comes along with the public markets because I've got enough invested in that way, what's next? And that's also a little bit of a disconnect with the majority of us as investors, where now it's time to look at the private markets, right? Now it's time to look at startup opportunities where, you know, maybe I have a friend who is really smart in XYZ thing, who's considering leaving their current employer to go take their shot at developing so-and-so company. And I have an opportunity to be in there from the very beginning with, once again, some very positive tax implications if this thing goes really well. And I could be investing in that way. Or maybe I go buy into a franchise concept of some sort, something that's already tried and true and will pay me a significant level of dividend income beyond, you know, what I can get in the public markets. There's so many other opportunities out there. So that's really what I think is another really important thing for people to be thinking about, is what's beyond the public markets that I, as maybe an accredited investor, say, has access to and should be looking to get into.
Yeah, for sure. So before we kind of dig too far into that, you know, trajectory, one thing you mentioned a few times was, you know, investing for appreciation versus cash flow, or how that kind of factors in. And for better or worse, those are two incredibly hot buzzwords. You know, you constantly hear the talking heads of the Dave Ramseys and the everyone else talking about these different things. But understanding kind of where that maybe fits in, and I always like to get people in the actual industry's opinion on it. You know, for where do those kind of two things fit in on investing for appreciation versus investing for current cash flow? You know, is it something that we should, you know, look to blend? Is it really kind of unique to each person? But again, you know, just kind of at a high level, what are your opinions on where people should kind of factor those things into their investment strategy?
Yeah, I'll try not to take too much offense to you calling me a talking head, since I am a CNBC contributor and then to show up when they're giving my opinion on whatever the news of the day is. No, I'm kidding. I don't consider myself that at all. But I think what you're describing is the difference between investing for retirement, a traditional retirement, and investing for financial independence. And what I mean by that is, when we invest for retirement in the traditional way, you're putting money away for 3, 4, maybe 5 decades that's going to support you when you're either no longer able or no longer want to be a full-time employee somewhere. And realistically, you're putting that money into a super high yield savings account. Like I just mentioned, it's going to get you about 10% on average each year. And that's going to be great once you turn 65, turning your paperwork, get your gold watch and sign up for the pension, right? That is how you invest for retirement. You come in the door at 25 or so, you stay for 40 years, you put away whatever the government will allow you to each year as it indexes for inflation, and your savings account is going to return you about 10% per year. And that's going to be great. On the flip side, for the folks that don't want to do retirement the traditional way, for the folks that say 40 years old, 50 years old, 60 years old, even, I'm out of here and I don't want to be on this 9-to-5 until 65 treadmill any longer than I have to be. That's where you have to be worrying about income. And that's where you have to be worried about parking those dollars in investable assets that are going to one day pay you to stay home. So maybe it's something that's appreciable today, and then you're going to take those dollars and invest in something that's income oriented tomorrow, right? So real estate, for example, is one that we always think about and talk about. It throws off pretty predictable, pretty quiet, pretty boring income, right? People pay their rent. You pay the mortgage if you have one, and whatever the difference is yours to spend on your expenses for the month. I'm oversimplifying a little bit because you got some additional expenses in there before you get to cash flow positivity. But the concept is kind of obvious. Park those dollars in real estate, rent gets paid, then I get to use that for whatever I want to throughout the course of a year or on a month-to-month basis, however your brain thinks about it. But on the flip side, I could also be thinking about small businesses. I mentioned franchise concepts, right? I could invest into a string of UPS stores that every quarter are paying out dividends to owners. And I'm going to take that quarterly dividend and fund my lifestyle from that. Or I'm going to fund a portion of my lifestyle from that dividend payment. Or, you know, I'm going to invest in a law firm or a cluster of accounting firms. I know these are very boring, stodgy businesses that people don't necessarily think about as the best thing to invest in. But boring and stodgy is also what's important when you think about an income producing asset, a financial independence plan, and how you're going to draw income. You want boring. You want predictable. You want something you can plan your whole life around. And so things like I'm describing are really what play into developing that sort of strategy.
And I really kind of like, you know, the larger image that you're posing is that, you know, the boring, predictable things that are out there are going to be, you know, the basis of what builds that to the point where you can go out and kind of roll the dice on some of these things, you know, talking about the, you know, the private equities market. And yeah, it's inherently very risky when you're talking about investing in true startups. And there's a few different things I want to break down for the next part of this conversation and how to do with, you know, what you were talking about. But again, it's, you know, like you mentioned before, you can, you know, you invest in private equity and startups with the hope that that one 10x buried in the middle of the four or five other ones really hits and that offsets all of your losses. And yes, you know, your 10x gets reduced and maybe you only doubled your money, but hey, doubling your money is still pretty sweet. I don't think anyone's going to turn their nose up about anything doubling in their financial portfolio. But you kind of brought up a few different things. And one I really do like that I've had the experience on this podcast to examine a lot more is investing in franchises. You know, you look at the statistics of newly established businesses and the failure rates, people shy away from it because, again, it, you know, they can be very risky. And, you know, to extrapolate that, startup companies, you know, inherently carry that risk as well. But franchising can really kind of bring the business systems and the support to individual business locations that otherwise business owners don't have to help increase their revenues, profitability, and viability in the long term. So I really want to kind of get some more opinions on that, on franchise investing, because again, something I never really thought of, you know, growing up, you see the Golden Arches, you see, you know, these things out there, but you know, there are so many different opportunities to invest in businesses that can really offer pretty solid returns and, you know, a lot more stability than otherwise. But a few things that you kind of brought up that I want to focus on, one being real estate. I always love to get, you know, people's opinion, especially in your world, on where real estate fits into portfolios, whether it's, you know, direct investing, whether that's investing through some type of REIT or other type of fund. But focusing again on kind of the business aspect of investing, whether that be franchises or startups and real estate and how those things can kind of blend together and in which bucket model that you attribute those to.
Yeah, so a lot in there, and you'll tell me if I don't completely answer the question, but I'm thinking about a handful of things. One, there's so much more to franchise ownership than just food service, and I'm saying just in quotation marks. A lot of times when we say franchise, people tend to think of McDonald's because it's probably the most popular franchise, and then Chick-fil-A because it's the most coveted franchise. But there's so many other things out there, like a massage envy, for example. Most people have interacted with a shopping center that has a massage envy in it at this point, right? You may not have ever gotten a massage, but you've seen the logo, you've walked past it, you've been in a shopping center that had it. Also, I mentioned like the UPS store, copy shops, all those kind of things. Some of Starbucks's locations are franchise concepts. And so I think it's really important to dig into what are the established opportunities that exist already before trying to go and start something from scratch? Because for a lot of people, I imagine, who are listening to this show, you have a day job already. You have a thing that you're good at, and you need to be able to plug and play your entrepreneurship, right? You don't necessarily want to go start something from scratch and have to take the risk that comes along with, is this even going to work? So there's something that's an opportunity out there that's referred to as absentee ownership, which is what we just described, right? It's the massage envies, it's the stretch zones or stretch labs or whatever they're called. Those kind of personal health kind of things where I can own three or four of them, hire good managers, hire good operators, and I literally am absent almost all of the time. That's where, you know, you're able to flex your business ownership dreams, but also have your day job and have the stability of I do this thing over here. And a few times a month, I have to check in and do these other things related to the business that I own. But it doesn't consume me the same way that being an entrepreneur consumes you until that thing shows, you know, some viability.
Yeah, for sure. And the other, sorry, just to interject on that, you talked about cool franchising opportunities. To echo that, they are as varied as the day is long. I actually had the CEO of a company called Spalding Decontamination on to this podcast. So if you've ever maybe had the misfortune of running across one of their videos when you're eating lunch on YouTube, but they go through and they clean up crime scenes, they clean up meth labs, they do all this stuff. And that's their whole business model. They're all over the US. And the owner, Laura Spalding, started as a cop in Memphis. And she asked the questions like, hey, what happens to these meth labs and these murder scenes afterwards? And they're like, I don't know, they're just left to figure it out on their own. And she goes around, buys real estate off people in distressed conditions because she knows how to clean up a meth lab and buys them for like, you know, 10 cents on the dollar. So there's options out there for people. If you think there's an opportunity, franchising is an awesome, really awesome avenue to look at.
You also just got at one of the key tenets that I go through multiple times in my book, which is being creative about finding ways to increase your income, right? So there's a limit to how much time all of us has in a day, but there's no limit to how much income you can generate in those hours that you have every day. What it really requires is that you be creative about how you're going to apply the expertise and the skill set that you already have. Leverage the education you've already gotten. You know, a lot of times when you say you want to go from this place to that place, people's brains think, oh, I got to go back to school. I got to get certified in something. I got to go do all this additional education. But realistically, if you've been doing something for 10 plus years, you probably already have enough expertise to figure out a way to create fractals of that same information and package it differently and use that as an additional income stream. And so I like that you mentioned that this lady was a cop previously, right? So a exposure and a skill set that she has that's unique to her that not a lot of us can just step into tomorrow, and then figured out a way to pivot that into, here's how I'm going to make money using this education that I have, this experience that I have, and I'm going to overlay this as a real estate play. Because where I was going with that was, a lot of the concepts that we think about that are franchises are, they provide the franchising company provides you with your location. They approve your location. And so one thing you might want to consider is, maybe I want to own a strip mall and I want it to be anchored by something I know will bring people in into the parking lot, and then also have additional services that people can get access to. And the way that I do that is franchise one name brand thing. I own the strip mall itself, and then allow people to, you know, add their quick service restaurants and add their, you know, bodegas or whatever the concept ends up being. And that's a way to be a real estate owner and have the income that comes along with the real estate, but also be a franchisee just long enough to get stability of that asset. Because, you know, the most popular thing that's attributed to Ray Kroc, the not founder, but the most important player in the McDonald's story, is once he realized he was not in the burger service restaurant, he was actually in the real estate business. That's when the light bulb went off. The franchising concept that we know today with the McDonald's story came to be. And so figuring out ways to overlay some sort of franchise ownership with a real estate play is definitely a great way to marry the best of both worlds. And now that cash flow that we're talking about is coming in from multiple different directions from that one asset. And oh my goodness, the tax opportunities there. Like, I haven't even begun to get into how that impacts your life.
Yeah, no. And that's one of the things that, you know, is super beneficial about you know, real estate, unlike a lot of other types of assets where it's mainly just kind of looking at a loss versus a gain or the income that you receive into it. You know, for better or worse, a lot of investing that people are exposed to, the taxes are relatively simple. You know, when did you buy it? When did you sell it? Did you have dividends that came off of it? When were they paid? How long did you hold it? You know, it's not a, you know, hugely complex thing. And granted, that is the tip of the large iceberg when it comes to it. But, you know, for your neighbors, the people that you meet at the coffee shop, most people that you run into, that's the extent of really kind of what they, you know, are exposed to. But when you want to start kind of generating, you know, more revenue, and you really want to get to that point where you don't just want to wait till, like you said, you're 65 and you punch out, get the gold watch and sign up for the pension, you need to be a lot more cognizant about this stuff. And one of the things, especially like you mentioned, you know, this is where I kind of want to transition, it being real estate, you know, real estate gives you the ability to make lots of money and create a lot of ways to reduce your exposure to taxes. Mm-hmm. Because it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. And that is one of the things that I am, you know, personally very passionate about in my career, is how real estate can help people. Granted, what we do in the IRAs isn't so much personally beneficial because it's all tax-free anyway. But, you know, to the point of what you were saying, I think you kind of had a little bit of a passion point there of just how, you know, awesome real estate can be in there. So, you know, what are your kind of thoughts on where real estate might play into people's portfolios? And what are some of the things that people can look for in different categories of how that can help them to keep more of the money they earn?
Yeah, I think one of the big things that we should be considering, you and I as practitioners in this space, should help people consider. This is, again, is a core tenet inside the book that I'm talking about, Financial Independence Doesn't Happen by Accident. It's building a business that supports your lifestyle, or building a business around your lifestyle. And what I mean by that is the way that the tax code is set up, it incentivizes the types of activities that the government wants to see. The government doesn't want to be in the business of having to create jobs, but they want all Americans who want a job to have a job, right? It's the reason we're at historically low unemployment today. Everybody who has a job wants a job, basically, except for 3.5% of the US population, is the way that number is supposed to make sense. So they incentivize business ownership and incentivize you as a business owner to go and create jobs. On the flip side, the government doesn't want to be responsible for making sure that everybody who wants a house has a house. So they incentivize you as a landlord to go and create housing for people and give you the tax benefits for being willing to go and do so. And so building your real estate business around your lifestyle is another way to have your cake and eat it too. It's a way to make sure that you are, instead of the way most people operate in this country, which is they earn income, then they pay taxes, and then they spend what's left. The way that I am recommending that people think about this is to earn income, spend the money, and then pay taxes on whatever's left. And business ownership, especially a real estate business, allows you to do that. And so building your real estate business around what you personally want to be able to do, right? So your travel, for example, there are ways to make your travel count as business expenses as long as you check the necessary boxes that the IRS requires you to when you go and travel. So if I want to go over to a place like Turks and Caicos in the Caribbean, and I want that to be a tax advantaged trip, well, if I'm in the business of real estate, I check all those boxes as far as the IRS is concerned. When I go and look at real estate opportunities in Turks and Caicos, my trip that I just took with my family is a tax advantaged trip. So now I earned money, I spent the money, and I'll pay the IRS on whatever's left over, assuming there is anything. But I got to have my trip in there as a person who's in the real estate business. Or to make it a little bit more personal, to answer your question a little more directly too, one of my own personal goals coming up pretty soon here is to buy a beach house. My family, a couple times a year, will go and rent a house at a beach and go hang out there and enjoy, you know, the sun and the water and everything else. But when I talk about building your business around your life, one of my own personal next goals is to buy a beach house at one of our favorite beaches and turn that into an investment property that then pays for us to go and enjoy that beach the same couple times a year that we normally would. The only difference now is the people who come and stay at this investment property are paying for us to go to the beach. Then the money that I earn from going to the beach is taxed. If it's not tax-free, it's at least tax-advantaged, right? Depending on how things are structured. And so that's also what I want you to kind of consider in that equation. It's not just an economics equation, right? It's not just, can I make money on this property when I go to sell it? Can I save on taxes by owning this property? It's also, how does my quality of life get improved by being able to go to the beach with my family two times a year in this way? And now that my quality of life is enhanced, now let me figure out a way to do that that's most economically optimal. And now I get the best of both worlds. And that's the way that I think about these bigger decisions when it comes to money. It's lifestyle plus the economics. And how can we marry the two of those together?
For sure. And I think that brings up a good point is, you know, figuring out, you know, what you want out of this life. So when it, you know, when it comes to talking to a client, you know, being a financial planner and helping people kind of decide on all these different avenues, because, you know, not everyone wants to invest in real estate. Not everyone wants to invest in startup companies, but everyone has, you know, universally has a certain lifestyle that they want to maintain. That could be, you know, being a hermit in the mountains. That could be, you know, going and living in a Ibiza and going to a nightclub every night. You know, no judgment, but everyone has that commonality between them, which is, you know, interesting. There's very few things that every single person on this planet has, but it is a desire to maintain something. They're all different, but again, the general thought is the same. So, you know, when you're talking to a new client or you're talking to an existing client, and, you know, I would imagine that you probably have that conversation of like, you know, let's figure out, you know, the what and the why, and then we'll figure out the how to support that. So where do you kind of go through that? You know, what are some things that you kind of look at with someone to figure out saying, hey, you know, this is, you know, what could afford this for you, or, hey, this is kind of fitting into what you personally want out of stuff. How do those conversations kind of go, and how do you determine, you know, what maybe is a good fit for someone versus, you know, another avenue?
Yeah. So in our onboarding process with new clients, one of the steps is what we call a money psychology meeting, where we literally put away all the ones and zeros and we don't talk about math and assets at all. And it's a more of a conversation about what matters to you. Who are you as a person? What do you care about? And what things would you like this money to accomplish for you? So not the other way around. We want to figure out how to help you get more life out of your money. And so one of the questions that I love to ask people as part of that meeting is, what is on your bucket list that if you went to your doctor today and got a diagnosis that you have 24 hours left to live, you would regret having not done? And a lot of times it will cause people to like sit there quietly for a couple of minutes. And this is very tough to do because, you know, we're communicators by nature, but people will sit in silence and we give them as long as they need to form the words to answer that question, because that can be pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. But then they usually come back with something that is not all that outrageous in scope. So I'll say, you know, Alex, you got 24 hours left. What's on your bucket list that you'll regret having never done before? And it'll be something like, you know, my family is from Ireland or something, and I'd really love to take a week-long excursion through Ireland, learning how to make XYZ type of food that our family's really passionate about. And I will, in jest, just to try and add some levity to the conversation, go, that's it? Like, you know, because on one hand, I'm, again, just kind of joking, but in reality, that's not that tough to do. The tough thing is actually making the time to do the thing that we say that we want to be able to do. So we spend so much time making the money and so much time focused on making the money and getting to the next thing and achieving the next thing that we don't necessarily stop to take the time to do the things with the people that we say we care so much about having the money for, to be able to do the things with. And then all of a sudden, when we're 70 and 80, we want our family to spend time with us because we got nothing but time at that point. But people are where they are. They're going where they're going to go, and they're focused on what they're focused on. And so how life-changing would it be to be able to take that family trip to Ireland at 50 when your kids are in high school or college? And then when we start to do the math and we backtrack, we realize it's really only going to take $10,000, $20,000 to get you and your family to Ireland for that week-long trip, doing all the excursions and all the food tours and all the stuff that you really wanted to do. And then we look and we see this $20,000 is not actually going to knock you off course to that financial independence plan that you came in the door saying you wanted to achieve. Your kids are still going to be able to go to college. You're still going to be able to make full-time work an option by the time you're 60 years old. You're still going to be able to buy the next house that you're concerned about buying, or the Cybertruck, or whatever, you know, is the thing on the list for you. This $20,000 trip is not going to rock your world at all financially. Or maybe it is. Maybe it means you have to work an additional year or an additional 6 months, or you have to bank this bonus instead of spending that money on the Cybertruck, or whatever the thing is, the trade-off. We're focused on helping you identify what the goal is. I put a dollar figure to it, and then make a decision about what is it going to cost me to be able to do that thing? And what do I have to give up in order to have that, if anything? Because a lot of times we scare ourselves into thinking we have to give something up. And in reality, we're even more close to that goal than we even realize. And so that's the big thing, is just helping people identify what the thing is first, then assign a dollar value to it, then decide how much of a priority is it really? And give them permission to take action on it. If they say, you know, it's in my top five priorities, I really want to do this thing. I mean, how life-changing would a trip like that be?
No, absolutely. And what I'm kind of hearing from you, which is, you know, maybe not necessarily something that everyone picks up on, but it's not so much necessarily getting the basis is not, you know, figuring out, oh, you have, you don't start with saying, okay, well, we need to have X money coming in here, Y money going there. It's really more of a time management conversation. You know, how do you want to manage your time? What do you want your time to be spent? Is it with your family going on that vacation to Europe? Is it, you know, grinding every day and making as much money possible so that way you can, you know, sit on your deathbed and see, you know, three commas in your bank account? You know, what is, you know, kind of your time management utilization look like?
It's a resource management.
You know, going from there. Yeah, resource management. Absolutely. So, you know, from that perspective, where do the avenues of kind of what we talked about today, because they all have different amounts of, you know, time suck, you know, being a full-time landlord is a full-time job. You know, if you have 10 rentals or, you know, 20 or 30 rentals and you're managing all those, yeah, you might've quit your 9-to-5, but now you gave up a 9-to-5 for a, you know, a 6-day-a-week, 10-hour-a-day thing. So yeah, it's, you know, dealing with toilets, tenants, and termites, you know, is its own job in and of itself, or going out and buying, you know, directly buying into a franchise is, you know, another way. It could, and the nice thing about all these different things that we've talked about, there's a lot of different ways to invest in them. You don't just have to buy the house and be a landlord. You could lend someone the money. You could hold the paper. You could invest as a joint venture with someone. You could be the financing on someone's franchise, or you could be a silent partner in something. So there's a lot of different ways to play this stuff out. And maybe kind of the next step when it comes to, you know, figuring this stuff out with people, you know, when you explain the options to them of saying, hey, you know, here's what we can do in the stock market, here's what investing in real estate, or here's what looking at businesses looks like, you know, what does that look like? You know, which ones do you feel are the most time intensive, and which ones do you, you know, where's that balancing act?
It depends on the person and what their interests are. I know most people, when they sit down to talk to a financial planner, hate that the answer to most of your questions is it depends. But this is one of those. And the reason I say that is because I look at life as a series of sprints instead of one long marathon. I have been a landlord before. I am not a landlord today, nor do I want to be a landlord tomorrow. However, sure. I think there is a point in my life where I will say I have enough bandwidth to do it myself. I have enough interest to do it myself. I have enough access to people and information to do it myself. And then I'll take that step to want to do that. But I'll also be clear with myself about why I'm doing it that way. So I right now own real estate, but through a private real estate investment trust. So I think my return on the total return plus, you know, dividends is something like 8-ish% per year over the last 5 years. If I was to buy a single family home and get it cash flow positive at any point am I going to see more than an 8% return looking back over, you know, the previous 5 years? Maybe, but probably not. It really depends on where I buy it, when I buy it, how much of my own money I have tied up in this thing, how much are interest rates right now. Like, there's so many things that go into that equation that make it tough to say it's a one size fits all solution. I personally don't love single family home ownership as a real estate play. I'd much prefer multifamily, you know, 10 door apartment building where four tenants means that I'm breaking even and everything from that point on becomes cash flow positivity. I'm just throwing a number out there. So don't anybody think that that equation is the gospel, but I just don't like the idea that my ability to pay the mortgage on this property is tied to one singular tenant. So having the ability to spread that risk across multiple people makes me feel a little bit better about owning that asset. That's all. Now, that does mean I have a lot more headache because there's 10 toilets to break now and there's, you know, 10 tenants to destroy the property now and all those things that go along with it. But that is my preferred method of property ownership if and when I want to own the physical asset. But in the meantime, I think it's important, again, just think about, why are you getting into this business, right? Am I a person who just wants the immediate appreciation from turning over the property in 6 months? If I'm a quick flip investment person and I want to be the bank and I'm going to get a 15% return as a hard money lender every time I give money to my buddy who flips houses successfully, okay, great. Let that be your thesis for how and why and when you invest. If I am a buy and hold until the day I die kind of investor, okay, then great. But be that and don't try to be all the other things. That's the place I think most people go wrong wanting to be real estate investors. It's trying to do all of the different approaches there are to investing in real estate, because that doesn't allow you very much opportunity to learn how to do one thing very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many different things that go into real estate. Being someone that can be an expert in one or two of them will pay immense dividends, because like you said, I've seen it throughout the entirety of my career, and people have, you know, different levels of success, but, you know, trying to do too many things at once, you know, think about, you know, cooking Thanksgiving dinner by yourself. You know, you got the turkey and you got this, that, and that done, but, oh, I just forgot that the, you know, sweet potato casserole got left in the oven too long. You know, do everything else right, but you can get burned, you know, on one thing. So again, that's a very good point to make. And what I kind of like to bring this into perspective on the end of it, you know, we've kind of talked about the middle, beginning, and the end, but at least going forward, you always like to get people that have their pulse on the, you know, the broader financial planning market and investment, you know, allocations with people. Where do you kind of see some of the next trends going? What are some things that you think people, you know, should, you know, kind of keep a weather eye on? You know, are the stalwarts going to still be there in 10, 15 years? And where do you see some of these market shifts coming? Because, you know, again, the news loves to preach doom and gloom, but, you know, they've been preaching that doom and gloom since, you know, May of 2020, and there's been billions made by people. Not that that is sustainable by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, it's always good to get people's opinion on that part of it when I have people as expert in that field as you are.
Yeah, the trend that I'm noticing the most, especially with our clients, and so I'm talking about folks who are probably in their early 40s to mid 50s, let's call it, who are starting to focus now on alternatives in a way that they never had before. And so you were talking about like private equity as an example, private credit as a separate example. I mentioned venture investing as a separate piece. We talked about private real estate quite a bit, all of those different things that make up alternatives buckets. But even drilling down deeper into a private credit fund that is thematic, or a private equity fund that is thematic. So if you think about Vista Equity Partners, for example, I'll just use them because I was just reading about them, and their focus on SaaS companies, software as a service, and their focus on SaaS companies that have a very specific profile and meet a very specific criteria. And then their focus on SaaS companies that meet a specific profile that have a expected timeline less than 7 years. And then, and it drills deeper and deeper and deeper. And what I'm finding is the private investing market, the alternatives market, is becoming way more nuanced than it's ever been before. And it's also becoming way more accessible than it's ever been before. So you have things like BREIT, for example, from Blackstone that allow you to invest in private real estate, or BCRED that allows you to invest in private credit. But that's kind of a brand name, if you will. Or like Jones Lang LaSalle, for example, has a private real estate fund that's their flagship fund. That's kind of a brand name if this is what you do. But there's a lot of other smaller alternatives funds that are popping up left and right. I get emails from 3, 4, maybe 5 on a daily basis. Please give us a look. So then you have the industry that sits in the middle now, the cottage industry, like the iCapitals of the world, that will review all these different alternatives for you to give you their opinion and institutional research and everything else on these different alternatives. But that whole market wasn't nearly as loud and proud as it is today when I worked at Merrill Lynch all those years ago, starting my career. Like, we were just starting to talk about alternatives as a reasonable allocation, you know, on a 60-40 portfolio. Maybe now you're going 50-40-10, right? And that 10 being alternatives. Or I don't even think they were willing to incorporate that much. I think it was like, give alternatives 2-5% of your portfolio allocation. And now I talk to people that like 25% of their portfolio is in alternatives. And these are some pretty sophisticated people that this is what they're exposed to now by being able to read about, listen to podcasts like this, watch, you know, YouTube videos from credible sources, not just anybody with an opinion. Like, there's a lot more out there in the world of alternatives. And so I see that as a place that a lot of investors, especially accredited and sophisticated investors, are going toward, that I think is going to stay a trend for the next 10, 15, 20 years, like you said, but is also going to have some very positive explosion to it. And also, frankly, some very negative explosion to it. I think there's going to be some junk that gets hidden up underneath the surface that gets passed along to unsuspecting, you know, investors who don't do enough research, and or this thing gets hidden so well that you couldn't tell if you wanted to. Kind of like FTX, for example, when you got Tom Brady telling you this is the thing and Tom Brady's your guy, it's kind of tough to assume on its face that it's not at least worth looking at. Now, I am not a crypto investor, so I should say that, you know, with that level of skepticism that I have for all things crypto related, but I can certainly understand how the average person looks at like the FTX arena and says, oh, these people are legit. Or the founder of FTX is testifying on the Hill and you say, oh, this guy seems legit. Like, so I think there's some of that that can happen underneath the surface, which is the danger that I'm concerned about. But I also think there are positives that can come from alternatives blowing up where that they have into the zeitgeist, because usually the best returns come when the company is private and they can have 10, 20, 30% returns on a year over year basis, because people don't know as much about it and there's not as much funneled into it. Then when it makes it to the public sector, public markets, the juice has likely been squeezed.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I would kind of tack onto that, one thing I really enjoy about the private markets that I've seen over my career, under the Obama administration with the passing of the Jobs Act, of really kind of democratizing the, you know, private investment sector. Granted, still there are a lot of roadblocks for some of the larger positions that you're going to be into by needing to be accredited. But with the advent of things like Regulation A offerings, where if you want to get your, you know, your beak wet in it, you know, you don't have to have 50, 75, 100,000, have all these income limitations. You can, as a smaller investor, get exposed to these things. And I will say this with a huge, if I could, you know, paint it across the background as much as I could, you know, these are inherently very, you know, can be very risky investments. So if you only have $5,000 to spend, putting it all into anything, you know, it's just, you know, just like if you only had $10 million to spend, you put it all in one thing, there's a risk profile there. So be careful. But the, you know, the broader sense of the fact that, you know, the popularity of the private markets is one thing that I really like, because there is, to your explanation, the juice has been squeezed when it gets to the New York Stock Exchange or it gets on the NASDAQ. You know, people have, you know, gone in there, carved it up. Then you have, you know, your Vanguards and your iCapital. You have all these people coming in that are just going to take these huge tranche positions. And, you know, they like to say they don't manipulate markets, but, you know, that's, you know,
maybe they don't, but there is a level of financial engineering that goes on, right? I am Google. I think
that's a very good
Alphabet. I haven't done anything innovative in a while, and so I'm going to now start offering a dividend. Or I am Apple, and I haven't done anything innovative in a while, and so I'm going to announce $110 billion stock buyback, so you stick with us. That's financial engineering, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Or, yeah, you know, to pick on Elon a little bit, you know, announcing the Cybertruck and not delivering anything for 6 years and then barely delivering when they come out. So, again, it's the nice thing is about that. But again, with your, you know, perspective, you know, with increased attention brings increased bad actors. You know, it's just a ratio. You know, it's if there's only a few people in it, then the likelihood of someone getting away with something's low. If you have tons and tons of people in it, well, you know, that bad element can and will. Ultimately, and it's life, you know, people will act in their own self-interest to the detriment of others. So be careful, especially in the private markets, having someone like yourself that you can go to and, you know, understand this stuff on a very granular level to be safe and protected. Can't recommend that enough. With that said, we are kind of at the end of our time, but Malcolm, you know, you certainly do have your book that's coming out. Is that already available, or is there some place people can buy it? Is it on Amazon?
Where's it at? On Amazon, already available. Financial Independence Doesn't Happen by Accident, hardcover, paperback, and Kindle version now available.
All right, fantastic. And if they'd like to get more in touch with you with regard to any services that you have to offer, whether it be financial planning or anything else, what's the best way for them to reach
you? So MalcolmEtheridge.com, Etheridge, .com. There's a services tab. There's a book tab. There's all kinds of stuff. And if you want to send an email, hello@MalcolmEtheridge.com, best place to do that. And I am Malcolm on Money on all social medias.
Well, Malcolm, thank you so much for being with us today. It especially rings true with this conversation, but I always like to end with the most valuable resource we all have is our time, because we can't earn or make any more of it. So thank you for taking time out of your day to spend it with us. With that said, my name is Alex Perney. This has been the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Thanks for joining with us, and we'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at advantaira.com and subscribe.